Welcome to Fundamentally Human, a podcast about mental health topics unpacked in an easy-to-understand way. My name is Shervin, and I'm your host. Let's get started. So a theme that I've heard frequently in a number of my sessions with my clients in therapy is that they feel like they're going on autopilot, like they're watching from the outside in, that they're really bored, they have no hobbies, it's hard to make friends, and really, at the end of the day, they don't know what they're doing with their lives. And when they ask me what they should do when they're in this rut, the word fulfillment often comes up. And I wanted to be able to talk about this because it's something I experience, and I'm sure a lot of our friends and family and maybe you have experienced throughout your life. So in today's episode, I enlisted in the help of Paul Singh to talk about the key to living a meaningful life. Welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thanks, Shervin. Nice to be here.
And before we get started, can you introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, my name is Paul Singh. I'm a therapist and live in Vancouver Island, BC. And I work right now for an organization called Alavita Health that specializes in helping people to change their relationship with alcohol and other substances. But I've been a therapist for about 20 years, working in a number of different capacities, number of different populations, both on the mental health and the addiction side. And this is kind of a second career for me. I spent the first part of my career being a corporate lawyer, but maybe pertinently to our topic today, decided to become a therapist to, in effect, try to live a more meaningful life myself.
That's a really interesting, introduction there. It's not the first time I've heard it, but I remember the first time you described it where you changed your career because you wanted something more meaningful. I wonder if you can share more about that.
I think that to me, I think that part of the thing that, I think one of the keys to living a meaningful life is to know what brings meaning, what really will bring meaning to a person's life. And one thing I've certainly found in my life is that that hasn't always been able to, I haven't always been able to discern that. And I think I chased a lot of false idols and false gods thinking that they would bring me meaning and fulfillment, only to find in the end that they didn't deliver the satisfaction I thought they would. And quite frankly, in the first part of my career, I really thought that meaning and fulfillment in life was largely a product of success. And so I chose to become a corporate lawyer, a job that at the time I thought held the highest prestige and status of any job that I could potentially get. And I tried to go to the best Ivy League schools and work in the largest corporate firms, all of which I thought would lead me to a point where I felt fulfilled and happy in my life. But one of the things that I found, much to my surprise, is that even when I had accomplished the things that I thought would bring me meaning and fulfillment, they didn't. And I still felt kind of empty and bereft and kind of lost. And I had that feeling that I think a lot of people, that feeling expressed in that old 1950s song, is this all there is? And I think that began a quest for me to really find out what is it in life that that brings meaning and fulfillment. And of course, for everyone, it's different. But for me, one of the things that I wanted to do was to work not on legal problems, but on human problems, and to work to try to alleviate suffering of people in whatever small way I could contribute to that. And I think it was that that realization that spawned my move from being a corporate lawyer to becoming a therapist.
Thanks for sharing that. And while I didn't go into a different career per se before being a therapist, I remember when I was younger, for my parents, it was constantly, be a lawyer, be a doctor, get into some type of professional degree because it was important. The optics were always important. How much money we made, how it looks like to other family or friends, and the reputation. And it's always about chasing that dream. And of course, there's nothing wrong with being in those fields, nothing like that. But, how I think of it, being a doctor, you really need to also enjoy the science. It's not just helping people. It's a whole career that you need to be involved in. But growing up, it's, it gives you that prestige, or you're helping people. And I think we often shadow the actual meaning behind certain jobs, let's say, going to this example, with a lot of the dreams and hopes and standards that social media or parents or society paints for us. And on that topic of having a meaningful life and the word fulfillment, what does that look like to you, Paul?
Well, let me just comment on your, you know, on your first thought about, yeah, I also grew up kind of in an immigrant family, and my parents, I think, also similarly pushed me and my brother towards these kinds of high status jobs. It's probably no accident that I turned out to be a lawyer, my brother's a doctor. And I think that my parents were very well intentioned on that. They thought that that would actually be one of the keys to my fulfillment in life. But I think it highlights something that, I've found in the course of my life, and I think now has turned out to be very much buttressed by research, which is that it turns out that many of us are not very good at predicting what will make us happy in the future. We think we are. We think we know the things that will lead to fulfillment. But oftentimes we, like I did for much of my life, chase goals that appear to bring happiness and fulfillment, but in the end are mirages and don't deliver the satisfaction they promise. And so, you know, one thing that I had to do actually after I had my disillusionment of accomplishing things that I thought would bring fulfillment but didn't, is that I actually then had to actually go back to the drawing board and begin to read and think about what is it that brings happiness in life. And thankfully at the time, a whole new branch of psychology, which was called positive psychology, had been formed. And positive psychology is the academic and scientific study of the things that cause people to thrive in life. It is in many ways the reverse of what traditional psychology is about, which is concerning illness and disease and disorders and things that are essentially wrong with people. A group of psychologists got together and said, hey, how come we're not studying what is essentially right with people? And people who have high degrees of happiness and fulfillment and meaning, what are they doing? What do they got? And so a whole new field was born. And now this field has generated obviously tremendous research, and articles about positive psychology appear in national magazines and newspapers. And actually, even a positive psychologist was the first psychologist to win the Nobel Prize in economics. And so from this research, I think, I've learned a lot more, or maybe you might say I was reminded of what I kind of deep down always knew but forgot as to the things that bring fulfillment in life. And again, it's a personal thing, right? I'm not suggesting that, you know, what research says will work for everyone. But I can tell you one lesson that I got out of that is that to me, and I think this is evidenced by the research, the single factor that most leads to fulfillment in life are strong personal relationships. And I read that one time, just a very simple idea that really hit that point home for me. And the guy had said, simply sit back and imagine the three happiest moments in your life up to now. Once you've got that in your mind, then ask yourself, what do those three happiest moments all have in common? And he said, if you do that, you will find that every single one arises in the context of a relationship with another human being. It doesn't arise at work. It doesn't arise for, you know, a success. It doesn't arise from financial reward. It arises from relationships with others. And that simple realization was a kind of a game changer for me. And so I shifted my focus, not only career-wise, but in much more of a significant sense, in a priority-wise, from focusing on accomplishment and success professionally to accomplishment and success personally and relationally. I really think that it's not the guy with the most toys at the end of life who wins. It's the guy with the best friends.
That's really true, because when I reflect back on, you know, my 20s, I think about how my late teens, early 20s, there was a lot of pressure to talk to a lot of people, be friends with everybody, get involved in, at that time, UBC social life, and just put in so much effort to please every single person without prioritizing myself. And now something that I've learned many, many years later is it's okay if people don't like me or if I don't like people, because you're not always going to like everybody and not everyone is always going to like you, as long as, you know, you might be working on things that you might be Let's say if I'm always late, then that's something that I can work on. But if certain people don't like certain things about me, then I don't need to change all of that. And in that sense, you know, that's another way to even build deeper connections, because you find the people in your life that you connect with well, and you don't have to please every single person. And you're able to find those relationships that are more meaningful and thoughtful. And that was a bit of a tangent, but I also wanted to address what you talked about, positive psychology. I'm actually a bit on the fence of using the word positive. For me, I much prefer the word neutral as a baseline, because, you know, there's things like toxic positivity or trying to always look on the brighter side or the greener side of the grass. And that can be really, really tough on people, because it holds some type of standard or expectation that things always need to be happy or well. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. My understanding is that positive psychology is not about simply, kind of always, keeping a cheerful, viewpoint on things and repeating affirmations to yourself about how things are great. I think it really is more about what I was just talking about, which is just that some scientists got together and decided to study what were the factors that led to human flourishing. That, again, we were so focused as a discipline on essentially studying disorders and diseases in people, but we weren't spending the same amount of time trying to figure out what are the people that are really living good lives, happy lives, fulfilled lives. What are they doing? What do they have? What is their outlook? And so I think that whole field has offered much to commend it. And I think certainly it's been very instrumental in my own thinking about the directions that I want to go in to try to live the best life I can personally.
I appreciate you clarifying that, because while, we don't always have to work towards having the most cheerful perspective on an outlook, the key message there would be being able to reframe situations. How can you see something in a different way? Or how can you make this meaningful for you? And going back to the very beginning, when I mentioned about questions that my clients have, one of them is, they don't know what they're doing with their lives. They just feel so bored, or they're going on autopilot. What would you say to clients or listeners or people going through these kind of thoughts and moments?
Yeah. Well, two things. Just one in response to the comment that you made, a second ago. I mean, I think, well, actually, let me just address the one you just mentioned. I mean, I think in terms of people that are feeling kind of stuck and directionless and maybe have some ennui in life, I mean, I think that's a very common experience. I'm sure we can all kind of relate to that. I'll tell you one thing again. I heard someone say on the internet, it made a big impression on me. This guy said the solution to boredom in life is not to, quote, stay busy, like we think it might be. He said the solution to boredom in life is to find a passionate, all-consuming, overarching life goal. A goal that you would be so passionate about that you would be willing to spend several hours a day for the rest of your life working on. That struck me as a really interesting idea. And I think that can be one idea that people can maybe think about, that can help them to perhaps live a more kind of meaningful and focused life. Now, I'm not saying that passion is easy to find all the time. It wasn't, obviously I spent the first part of my life working in a passionless job, and I didn't immediately find, once I decided to leave the law, what my passion might be as I found it now. It took me a circuitous route, trying various things and them not working out and learning in the process before I found ultimately something that I would be passionate about to spend hours a day on, as I found in my work now. But I think it can be done with introspection and research about the external world to find, your unique place, which is a combination of your unique passions and your unique skills. And I think if you found that, that's one ingredient for having a pretty meaningful life. And by the way, that doesn't have to be your work. that can be in a number of different spheres of your life. It can be as a parent, it can be as a volunteer, it can be as a churchgoer, it can be in many different dimensions. It doesn't have to be in your career. But I think the key is to try to find something that you feel sufficiently passionate about that you would be willing to invest, you know, and give your life over to.
I love that. And when I reflect on myself, I would say that I'm usually someone who's not bored. And a big reason behind that is being able to find things that I enjoy doing. And that, like you said, it doesn't always have to be about your work. It could be maybe a sports team or going on hiking with people, or, you know, some of my clients, they enjoy cross-stitching, playing video games, just something that makes you feel like you're connecting with people or you're part of a community or that you feel passionate about learning and doing and spending time on. And of course, hopefully in a more healthy way. So I'm not telling people to play games for like 24 hours a day because that's not very good. Disclaimer there. But, you know, I play a lot of video games myself, and I usually play them in groups with friends, or we're in a call and we're talking and just being able to connect with people. So that's what you said earlier, that, you know, a lot of these happy memories that we have are usually related to other people and connected with other people and shared with other people. So yes, it's about finding a passion, but at the same time, it's also being able to interact and incorporate other people into your life so that there is meaning there. And something that comes up actually, Paul, with a lot of our addictions, or let's say clients who use substances and they're trying to quit, you know, we talk about this, and you've talked about this at Alavita before, being able to find something that brings them more meaning and more fulfillment than the substance at hand or the habit that you're trying to quit. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, various theorists have put forward the idea. Obviously, there's a lot of debate about what causes addiction, whether it's a disease or it's a learned behavior or personal choice. But leaving all that aside, some interesting ideas have been put forward by various people in the field that look at addiction as something that happens to someone that is essentially having a crisis of both meaning and connection. That they have, they perceive little meaning in their life, and often they feel disconnected, isolated, lonely, disenfranchised, right, from other people. And that because those two things are so painful in human existence, they often become motivated to find any way to take away that pain, even for a few hours, whether that's a bottle or a pipe or a joint. And so if we look at addiction from that more psychological lens, then for at least those clients for whom that's true, you can see that that becomes a big part of the work that we can help them to do. It's not about, right, just giving up the drinking or reducing the drinking. It's about dealing with the underlying need to drink. If you can deal with the need to drink and reduce that, oftentimes the drinking takes care of itself. And one of the things that for some people can very much help to reduce their need to drink are to find those two things that they may have been seeking all along, which is a sense of meaning and purpose in life and a sense of connection and community with others. So yeah, that's a big part of my work with a lot of clients. And, you know, my personal sense is that I think that it often can be very helpful.
Thanks for sharing that. And, you know, while not everyone might be struggling or have challenges with substance use, many of us do struggle with changing a bad habit or trying to have a good habit. And it all comes down back to just what gives you meaning and purpose. What's something better than that bad habit that you have? How can you get there? And it doesn't always have to be, let's say, a popular example would be losing weight. It doesn't mean you suddenly go to the gym 5 times a week, but it's looking at how can you reduce certain unhealthy foods in your diet, or how can you incorporate 10 more minutes of activity each week. And I think in the world of today, we're always thinking about how we can go from 0 to 100 right away. And even things like fulfillment or meaning in life, you can't get from 0 to 100 right away. Maybe if it's volunteering, finding a place where you can go once a month or once, you know, every other week, or finding a sports team to do one season of the league in. You know, little things that you can start incorporating in your life that can help you build up to that, I think is really important. You know, in the addictions world, we talk about harm reduction, being able to reduce in a healthy and gradual way. And it's the same thing in our lives. How can we introduce or, you know, have increments of the meaning and purpose in our lives? And I think you summed it up really well. It's about connection, and it's about finding that passion that you have. But at the same time, I've also heard people say, you know, I can't find that passion, or nothing interests me. What would you say to people who are going through that right now?
Yeah, I would say that, first of all, I can understand that, and I can appreciate that that can be a frustrating position to be in. But if I could be a little provocative, I think I would say something like, tell that person, you do have things that you're passionate about. Everybody does. You might not know what they are right now, but you do. And finding that, right? Finding your passion, finding your purpose, finding your calling, whatever you want to call it, that can be a hard process. And it requires, I think, a person to really, you know, dig deep and really look inside themselves as to what brings them joy and meaning. And then to see what opportunities in the world exist in which they might be able to find, right, expression for those things. So again, not an easy process. You know, my brother knew when he was 16 years old, for example, that he wanted to be a doctor. It was love at first sight. And he found his passion, for example, at a very early age and has never wavered from that. From me, it took until I was almost 45 and many ups and downs and trials and tribulations and false starts and to be able to find it, but it can be done. And I think doing it is one of the most important things you can do in life.
I find that being able to share that you changed your career at a later stage in your life is really inspiring, because, you know, we're taught to have a career for the rest of your life that you're really enjoy and you're passionate about, having a family and this and that age, a lot of standards that many of our parents and society has set for us. What was it like for you to have that career change at 45 when you've been established for so long? I know that a lot of the listeners are either finding their careers or they might be bored of what they're doing now and they're looking into switching their careers. What can you say for those experiencing that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I guess, you know, my thought would be that idea, right, which I think, yeah, was prevalent, for example, in the, you know, 1940s and 50s, is that, you know, you kind of established one career and stayed in it for your entire life. I just don't know how realistic that is in these days and times, that you would take a person at 16 years old or 17 years old, right, coming to the end of high school, and they should know themselves well enough and they should know the world well enough to be able to make a choice, say professionally, that they will stick with for the rest of their life. I just don't know how realistic that is. I think often for many of us, we have to live and experience and learn in order to be able to understand ourselves and what means stuff to us, and then to be able to understand more about the outside world and where we might be able to find expression in those things. In terms of my own personal journey, yeah, I mean, it was in many ways hard. In leaving law, I was, you know, turning my back on, you know, 10 years of practice, 3 years of law school, $100,000 in legal, you know, in law school expenses, the expectations of my parents and of my friends, and my own, you know, my own insecurities about, I think I did take, even though I didn't enjoy the work, I think I did take solace in the perceived status and prestige of that particular career. It helped me to feel better about myself. And going into a career in which that was neither nowhere near as highly paid and nowhere near as prestigious, I kind of worried about what effect it would have on me. And I can't say that it was easy and pleasant at all times, but I can tell you, looking back, it was the single best decision I ever made in my life. And I don't impress a lot of people at cocktail parties these days when I tell them what I do and where I work, but I'm the happiest I've ever been, the most fulfilled I've ever been. And if you can't tell it from my voice, you're one of them pretty passionate about what I do. So I guess I'm hoping that will be an inspiration to people that may have gotten into careers for maybe not the most thoughtful of reasons, understandably, much like me, but that there can be hope that you can find, even at a relatively later age in life, something that may be more in akin with your passions and strengths.
And something you had shared to me about a month ago was one of the happiest people could be someone who's last place or third place or whatever place in the race, but they feel like they've gotten to first place.
Yeah. And I think that gets to the issue, right? Which also research has found that really correlates with probably the one factor that most correlates, right, with kind of a happy and fulfilled and meaningful life is the concept of gratitude. And that's where that that idea had come from. Actually, it was something that my therapist had said to me. He, very wise guy. And I just asked him one time this same question that we've been talking about today. I said, hey, man, what do you think is the key to a happy life? And without blinking an eye, that's what he said. He said, a guy who's in third place who thinks he's in first place. So a guy maybe, you know, for example, who may not by objective standards have a lot, but who himself believes, man, I got it made in the shade. And that is a tough place to get to, I think, you know, for a lot of us. But I think it's one of the keys. One of the things that I'll just tell you is, you know, that in the course of my research, one of the things that I found is that, you know, scientists also studied, in addition to like, what are the big ticket things that bring happiness? They also looked at the question of what are some things that a person could do, for example, on a daily basis that could demonstrably improve their happiness. And so they looked at all kinds of different techniques from yoga to meditation to prayer to exercise. And many of these things did have a very substantial benefit on exercise or on the happiness. But they found one thing and one thing alone that had the greatest effect. And this effect lasted even after it was discontinued. And that was the practice of filling out what we could call a gratitude journal. Every day for 21 days in a row, to write down three different things that you feel grateful for. The only catch is you can't repeat. Now that might sound hokey and that might sound easy, but if you stop and think about it, you'll realize why something like that works. That process of writing down three things that you feel grateful for is real easy to do for the first 3 days. But once you've exhausted the obvious sources of your gratitude, that exercise forces you to scan your world and to take into account things that you would otherwise not notice, or if you noticed them, you would take them for granted, that are good with your life. And doing that over and over again, sometimes which involves straining to try to see what's positive that you can feel grateful for, that retrains the neural pathways in our minds to be more attentive to the things that are good, as opposed to our normal state, which is to only notice the things that are not so good. So gratitude is a huge kind of, I think, part of having a fulfilled life. All the research demonstrates that. And yeah, if you like that statement, that is a very, I think, powerful way to express it. The secret to happiness, a guy who's in third place, who thinks he's in first place.
You say that so much more eloquently, and I'm glad you gave it justice to the actual quote. But it's something that I think that I'll always take with me because it's so true. You know, a lot of your wins or celebrations in life, you know, maybe getting a raise or getting married, getting a car, those are nice achievements and milestones. But a lot of how you see success, how you see gratitude, or how you see great things in your life, it's relative to your own lens. And I've done a number of gratitude logs and journals where I write my daily gratitude. And you're right, it's things like the weather, or I had food that I really enjoyed today, or for me today, I would say my gratitude is I made some sunny side up eggs earlier this morning and they turned out perfectly. I'm so happy about that because, you know, sometimes you flip it and then it breaks the yolk and it's a mess and then it doesn't taste as good or overcooks. And just things like that can really help provide that meaning back into your life or make you feel happy or content or satisfied about things that you might even expect or normalize to be, you know, it should happen this way. I should have these things going for me. And when we introduce gratitude, it is a really humbling experience to go through, I think. And humbling in the sense that we don't always have to strive for perfection or expect things to always work out. We can be happy about the smallest of things, and those things really bring joy too.
I think you stumbled on a really important point, you know, and that is, I think, and I can certainly relate to this, that I think for many people, you know, we think that fulfillment and so forth will come from big, bold, dramatic things that happen to us in our lives. When I make partner, when I get that new job, when I get a girlfriend, when I have a sports car, when I buy a house, when I have a baby, then I'll be happy. And there's a lot of problems with that, one of which is that if you're waiting for the big, bold, dramatic, lightning out of the sky moments, those happen very infrequently in most people's lives. And in the process, you can miss some things that are much smaller, but if you look at them in the right way, can bring a lot of fulfillment. And so what you just said a moment ago is really beautiful and something that I think we could all, you know, learn from, myself included. To be able to take joy in being able to make sunny side eggs up perfectly. What a small, insignificant thing. But if it brings you joy, you might be one of those people that's in third place who thinks you're in first place.
Me all the time. I can't be in first place. People are too smart. You know, that's actually really true. There's always going to be someone who's smarter than you, someone who's prettier, someone who works harder. So many things. And realistically, you can't always be first in every single thing that you do. And even if you are first in what you do, there are different ways for you to continue to improve or to continue to find meaning in. And, you know, I never graduated my undergrad within 4 years, which was a lot of pressure to have at first, you know, finish your undergrad in 4 years, do your master's if you want to, but find a job right away that's high paying and then make sure you get married by this age and have kids. That's something that my parents have always told me. And, you know, my brother used to be a pharmacist. A lot of my friends are doctors and dentists. And when I remember when I was a teenager, I said, I'm going to be a heart surgeon because I thought it sounded really cool. There's a lot of prestige, a lot of money. I wanted to make my parents proud. And, you know, when I watched it on TV and movies, it looked really easy to do. But my journey in the last 10 years with school is pretty much not how I envisioned it to have. I would have liked it to be compared to when I was a kid, thinking I'd be a heart surgeon and married and have kids by 30. But, you know, all that to say, I think that I'm glad that I took my time to finish school because I met friends in my last year that I continue to see today and that I was able to really learn the subjects towards the end of school and didn't feel like I had to rush it. And then I didn't find a job right away, actually. After I graduated undergrad, I went to Asia for a month for a trip because I knew that once I started working, I wouldn't go on like a 1 month long trip right away. And then even after I started working, I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. And then only like 2 years after work, I applied to a master's and wanted to be a therapist. And here I am today in a role and in a job that didn't take me 4 years to find. But now I feel really, I guess, happy about this job because I see change in my clients and I'm able to help them get to that. And that to me is really fulfilling and brings a lot of meaning to my life, even though I won't make a fraction of the money a doctor or a heart surgeon would. Even if I don't necessarily quote unquote save a physical life, I do other things. And, you know, I'm not telling everyone they need to find like, you know, be a therapist or be a doctor or whatever. In any job, I think you can look for what gives you joy in that. Is it that you're learning from it, or you meeting people, or the company that you're part of. Even if, let's say, you're a dev and you're in a, I don't know, mental health company, you're doing something for that company. Now, I think we can all find some kind of meaning in what we do. And it doesn't have to be your job. It could be in our lives in general. That's a really long spiel, yeah, Paul.
No, I mean, I think it brought up two things for me. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the idea that your path to become a therapist wasn't linear. It reminds me again of another phrase someone told me once, which was, he said, sometimes in life, going slower is going faster. And, you know, being able to take your time and to be able to find out more about yourself and about, you know, what triggers your interests and your passions and what the world is like, and what are the opportunities that you, where you might have a chance to contribute, and where might you want to make that contribution? All of that, right? Even though it wasn't linear and quick, has resulted, you know, in you finding something that is very meaningful to you still at a relatively young age. I mean, contrast that with me, who went right from high school, right to university, right to law school, right to practicing, without taking any time to really contemplate myself or what I wanted to do in the world. And so that took me now, right, circuitously, right, till my 40s to be able to find that out. So I think there is some value in going slower, in thinking a bit about taking your time and trying to figure out where you wish to make a contribution in life. I think the other thing is, of course, about money. I think that, you know, if you ask most people, what are the things that bring happiness in life? If you ask them if money does that, they'll shake their head and say no. But then if you ask them, hey, what would a little bit more money make you a little bit more happy? Most of them will nod their head and say, yeah, you bet it will. I think we all have this belief that money brings happiness to some degree. And interestingly, in doing the research on this issue, that is true. But the interesting thing is only up to a point. And that is that I mentioned before the this positive psychologist who won the Nobel Prize. And one of his contributions to the field was to find out that, yes, making more money will lead to more happiness, but only at lower ends of the economic spectrum. So if you, for example, make $50,000, you will typically be more happy than someone who makes $10,000. But once your basic needs are satisfied and you enter the middle class and you have the basic things that you need, food, shelter, clothing, a little bit of excess cash for some enjoyments, one of the paradoxical findings is that making more money produces very little gain in additional happiness. And in this guy's research, he even found a number that he quantified, which is kind of the tipping point after which earning more money will not bring demonstrably more happiness, and that's $75,000 a year. And so his advice to everyone was, yeah, strive to try to make that if you can. But beyond that, spending more time and money trying to earn, you know, more time and energy trying to make more money will not yield very much more happiness. You can get more fulfillment by pursuing other things like strong relationships, like finding a sense of meaning and purpose, and a connection to something outside of yourself, by finding opportunities, right, to give back to other people and to develop a sense that you're reaching your potential in life and becoming the best version of yourself you can be. These are all things where you have bigger bang for the buck once you've met your basic economic standards.
And I love that you're able to bring the research in and what the quantifiable amount is. And you even say biggest bang for your buck, because yes, you could have a job that you make a lot of money in and you're able to go to more places or buy more things. But if you don't have meaningful connections or friendships, things that you like to do, hobbies that you like to have, a healthy physical life in terms of exercise and diet and all these little things that we take for granted, it doesn't matter how much money you have. You know, I know certain people that I've seen where they have a lot of money, but they don't have a lot of close friendships and they don't get to share experiences with people, or people aren't readily there to support them or be there for them because they didn't make that effort in to build a meaningful or thoughtful connection with others. So it is really important where you take care of yourself in terms of your basic needs, but that's not all there is to life.
Well, it just reminds me of, just a very interesting story that I read, in the course of my research. There was, several years ago, there was a series of kind of wildfires in the hills above Berkeley, California. And these wildfires affected neighborhoods of multi-million dollar homes, some of the most kind of palatial estates in the mountains that overlook Berkeley. And the way this wildfire proceeded is that the residents of this community had 15 minutes notice to evacuate their homes. And they were told by the fire departments they could go in and they could take anything they wanted from their house in 15 minutes, but then they had to leave and be out of there. And what was interesting, you can probably see where this is going, right? What were the items that were most commonly taken from these multi-million dollar palatial homes? They weren't the expensive stereo systems. They weren't the fur coats. They weren't the box of jewels. What were they? They were photo albums, memories of those people's experiences with other people. So I think that story shows, right, that even with people that have a lot of money and multi-million dollar palaces, that at the end of the day, they too know what it is that brings fulfillment in life. And that factor is far and away, and no other factor comes close: human connection and relationships.
Today, we talked a lot about connection and relationships. We talked about gratitude, finding passion or fulfillment in what you do. It doesn't have to just be your job. Are there any final comments or last words that you have for the listeners, Paul?
I think, I guess the story of my life is, and just to reiterate something I said, which is just to really think through what will bring happiness to you and your life, and to realize that we oftentimes are not very good at predicting that. We chase things that in the end don't deliver the satisfaction that they do. But to remember, right, what some of these things are that research shows really brings happiness in life, and see if that resonates with you. And I think that if you do, you will probably see that it has less to do with material possessions, money, success, status, and prestige, and far more to do with human connection and a sense of meaning and purpose and belonging and contribution and gratitude. And the good news is that many of those things are things that, for which no money is needed.
Thank you so much, Paul, for being here today. I really appreciate just all the wisdom that you have, and something, that you do is you bring up a lot of research and science and anecdotes, and it's really helpful seeing it from all different types of points of view, because we can all say, find passion and meaning. But what I liked about our conversation today is, the whys and the hows and what comes out of having passion, fulfillment, and unlocking that key to living a meaningful life. So thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Sharon.
To support my podcast and help reach others, please follow and share it with anyone who is looking to learn a bit more about mental health. For any listeners who are visual learners or would like some more resources, I invite you to read my blog posts on shervin.ca and to follow my Twitter at @HelloShervin and my Instagram at @TherapyWithShervin for updates. Bye, everyone.